Okay, on the line with us is Lee Richards, who was at WTMA back in the early to mid-70s. When exactly, Lee, were you here at this radio station?
Probably right during the mid part. I got there in December of 73 and left when Elvis Presley died, as a matter of fact. That was, what, August of 77?
All right. Now, what radio stations did you work for before you came to TMA?
I kind of bummed up and down the coast for a while. I was in Raleigh and Minneapolis. I worked for Kent Burkhardt in Minneapolis. And Wilmington, Delaware, of all places, is where I came to TMA from.
Is that where you're originally from?
I'm originally from Salt Lake City.
Okay. And you came to WTMA as not only a disc jockey, but also as the program director,
as
right?
As the program director, right.
And that was after a guy by the name of John Tritton decided not to be program director anymore. He had been PD for a long time. I think he had worked his way up to general manager, correct?
He had. There was someone else there before me, though, JJ. Can't remember his last name. But he was the program director when I got there. I took his place. I had answered an ad that wasn't in any of the mainstream magazines you'd think it would be in, but I just answered an ad and set the air check and the resume, and a couple of weeks later got a phone call from John, and I turned him down the first time he called.
And why is that?
I was pretty happy where I was at. Things were going fine, but within a week of turning him down, the whole upper management level at the station I was at changed, and we know what that's like.
Yep.
And I called John back, and I said, John, you still looking for somebody? He said, well, yeah. I said, well, how about me? I'm on the market. And he said, how soon can you be here? So we packed everything in the car and headed south to South Carolina.
And part of being the program director at WTMA was also doing the morning show, right?
Right, it was. Uh-huh.
Do you remember any of the discussions that you had with John Tritton on programming philosophy or anything like that? Or did he just say, it's already here, it's working, you know, don't mess it up?
That's basically what he said. He says, we've got a good thing going here, just, you know, here's the way we have it set up, and let me know what you're doing, and talk it over, and that was basically it. But John was the best manager I think I ever worked for in radio. Most of these guys come up through sales, and they have no concept of what programming is, or what you need to do to get it, or to keep it, or, you know, ratings or anything, but John knew all of that. It was very easy to go to John and say, we need to do this, or we need to do that, and he'd just look at you and say, well, why? And if you could give him a good reason, it was all right, we're going to do it. And it was wonderful that way because we got to do a lot of things that probably in other markets never would have been done.
Now, sometimes working for a guy who was a former program director like to meddle in your business. Did you find that the case with John Tritton as he was the general manager?
No, I did not. You know, when he needed to say something, he'd come say it, but he pretty much left the day-to-day operation us alone.
He didn't try to micromanage you or anything?
No, he did not. When he thought there was something that was wrong, he'd talk to you about it, and if you agreed, then you'd move ahead on what you were going to do about it. But if you didn't agree, then he'd sit and listen to your side of the story. And if you could justify yourself, if you could explain yourself in a way that, you know, he could buy into it, it stayed the way it was.
All right, WTMA was number one when you came here, and I guess it was number one through most of the 70s as well.
Yes, it was.
Every program director, when they come in, want to do something to kind of put their mark on the radio station. Do you remember anything that you did differently when you came to the station? Any changes you made?
There weren't any changes I made when I got there. I was just happy to realize where I'd ended up and the situation I was in. But, oh gosh, it was just before we had the book with the big numbers in it.
The ratings book.
About a year before that book, we kind of went a little soft in the ratings for a while there. John and Charles Smith decided that they wanted to bring in a consultant.
Charles Smith was the owner.
Yeah, he was the owner. And Charles had worked with somebody in Chicago in his old radio days that was now running a chain of stations across the country and doing quite well with them. They had stations in New York and Washington and Philly and San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago and San Diego, and they were quite successful in all these markets. So he called his friend in New York, and he sent his music director down, and we went through and kind of redefined the oldies library and what we would and wouldn't play as oldies, and then she got me started on market research, on really spending a couple of days going through Charleston and checking out what was going on there as far as record sales and stuff were concerned. And I'd do all this research and then every week get on a conference call with all the other program directors and we'd all feed our research in and then they'd come back and give us a playlist. And every radio station in the chain got the same playlist. And we came up a little in the first book. After that, the second book, it kind of was wishy-washy again. And I remember talking to John about it, and he said, well, I just don't know what to do. And I said, well, I've been doing this research every week extensively into the market, and I send it into them, and the playlist I get back is not what the research says we need to be playing. He said, oh, really? And I said, yeah. I says, why don't we cut the consultant free and let's just do our own research and program from it and see what happens. And he thought about that for a moment. He said, it makes sense. So they severed the relationship, and I started programming the records according to all of this research I was doing, and that's when we had the big book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Play what people are buying in Charleston. Who cares what they're playing in the rest of the country?
Yeah, yeah, that's true, and I could never quite understand why they wanted to keep doing that. But as soon as we made that change, boy, the numbers were right there immediately, and that was the ballgame right there.
Who are some of the other guys that you worked with at WTMA that you remember being there for a significant amount of time between 73 and 77?
Oh, gosh, a whole bunch of them. The main bunch of guys, I guess, were Keith Nichols and John Burwell, Bob Nash, Gary London. They were the main guys.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk Varner, he was our weekend guy. And Bob James on nights. There were a few people in and out. But these were the main guys that were there.
I understand you had a good conversation with Gary London the other night.
Oh, yeah, he called. We talked for a couple of hours. That was interesting to, you know, get caught up with him and what everybody's been doing. And he was a great jock. He really was. I don't remember what the run-in was with Bob Nash that he left and went across the street.
What, the KTM or CSC?
KTM.
Okay.
John Trenton said, oh, we'll be okay. Don't worry about it, you know. and I was really a little bit upset with that. We put Gary London in afternoon drive to take Bob's place, and boy, Gary took that and ran. I mean, he had better numbers than Bob did.
What about some of the news people you worked with in the morning or throughout the day?
The predominant ones that stick out with me are Al Cammy and Steve Bell. And Al did the mornings and Steve did the afternoons. And that was interesting to me, too, for a, back in the 70s, for a top 40 radio station to run a newscast basically was almost unheard of. And we had 10 minutes in morning and afternoon drive that we ran news in. But these guys knew the market, and they gathered the news and put it together very concisely and did a very good job. One story with Al Cammy, and it was really my fault, not his. We did the news in the afternoons and mornings at 25 minutes after to 35 minutes after. And we would set the cart machines up in the newsroom with the commercials in them. So Al, in the newsroom that was down the hall, had a remote start for them. And so I'd put the commercials in, and at some point during the morning, during one of those newscasts, I'd usually run out the door real quick and jump in the car and run down to McDonald's at the end of Orange Grove Road there and grab Al and I something to eat and run back. And we'd just gone putting all of our music on cart, and the engineer, Charlie McCann, had put a sequencer in. We had a little toggle switch on it. I mean, if you had the sequencer on, you could play two commercials and the jingle and start the first record without pushing any buttons. And this one morning, I put the three commercials in that were to run at different times throughout the 10-minute newscast. And after the last commercial, I had the jingle and the other record in so Al could start that. And I'd had an extra 3 or 4 minutes for the McDonald's run. And I bolted out the door, and I got back, and Al was standing there waiting for me, just madder than a wet hen. And says, you forgot to turn the sequencer off.
Oh, no.
I went to the first commercial break, and we played all three commercials and the jingle and the record.
Oh, man. Messed up his newscast, huh?
And he said, I didn't get to do my newscast. Besides that, you had 2 minutes of dead air back there.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, those guys, they were great. We had the television stations calling us for leads on news stories. That's how good Al and Steve were. They did with the news like the rest of the station did with the music.
Let's talk about the Lee Richards Morning Show. You were on the air doing the mornings for WTMA for several years. Do you remember much about the show? Any special features? Any bits you did on a regular basis? Things that people would listen to and say, oh, yeah, that's Lee Richards. That's what I remember about him.
No, oddly enough, I didn't. I mean, before I came there, I had all kinds of little characters on tapes and stuff that I'd run. It sounded like the studio was full of people, but John just didn't want any of that. He just wanted me to be there. So we just basically stuck to the basics. I did script in and do bits. I subscribed to 3 or 4 different joke services, and I would take material from them and adapt them to what was going on there or to the songs or something and use one-liners throughout, but that was basically it. It was just sticking to the basics, which they really don't do in radio anymore. And I think that's what added and made it the success was the consistency of that radio station. John used to say over and over again that people listened to the station because they liked it, and they came back because of what they had heard before, and if they didn't have that same experience when they came back, they wouldn't keep coming back like they did. So really the effort was put into making the station sound the same at 6 in the morning as it did at 6 in the afternoon, and to do that 24/7. We had a contest once where we took an old car and repainted it and had little WTMAs painted all over it. And we gave it away on the radio, and we'd drive it around and park it at different places at certain times and let the guys ride around and drive it. And we had several different people come in and paint the TMAs on it and kept that pretty much supervised so each painter didn't know what the other one had done. And we kept a total of it and stuff. And I remember we started the contest, and we'd give it away to the person that could come the closest to guessing how many WTMAs there were on the car.
Oh, cool.
The first day we started the contest, this whole stack of postcards came into the station. Gosh, postcards back then were what, a nickel or something?
Mm-hmm.
But this guy had gone and bought a whole stack of these things and started at about 500 and guessed in increments of 5 all the way up through. And I remember John Trenton came back and we were looking at those, and that was the contest right there. This guy had it the first day, but John just looked at me and he says, well, we're not going to announce the winner now, you know, just don't tell anybody. We'll just keep this thing going and we'll give it away in a month like we said we were going to. So
we used to call those contest pigs, but you probably had another name for them.
We had a lot of great promotions that we ran and a lot of great contests that raised some eyebrows in some instances, but were fun to do and fun for the people to listen to and participate in. We always tried to stay ahead of the competition, really, even in contests. When we'd read in the trade magazines about a good contest in another market, we always tried to be the first one on it. But back in the mid-70s, ACBQ at the time ran a contest called the Dirty Picture Contest.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was it was the ecology. Go out and take a picture of the dirtiest part of town and send it in. You know, we'll pick a winner and we'll go out and redo that and make something good out of it. And CSC jumped on it before we had a chance to. And I was talking with John one day and mentioned that. And he says, well, let's run our own Dirty Picture Contest. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, let's go on the air and ask people to send us a picture of the bottom half of the thing that turns them on the most. And I says, you're kidding me. He says, no, do it. So we ran this contest opposite CSC. Send us a picture of the bottom half of the thing that turns you on the most. I think John Trenton must still have the scrapbook somewhere. I'm not sure.
So you got a lot of reaction, huh?
Oh, boy, we did. A lot of talk to that. And actually, the winner was not a picture.
What was it?
Somebody had carved a soap on the rope.
Oh, okay.
And sent it in, and I think they attached a note to it that says, the only one that the more you rub it, the smaller it gets. John just had a wonderful time with that contest.
Probably didn't put those pictures on the WTMA surveys,
no,
huh?
No. We announced the winner, and we said, if you want to see who the winners are, you want to see what they are, drop by our studios any weekday between 8 and 5. We had a few people come in, but not that many. One thing we did do that worked quite well for us, got us in trouble with Arbitron, but since we had a way to get out of that, we started this little promo that we ran once an hour, 24/7, and I think it was the 07 stop set. We'd come out of that, and Keith Nichols, marvelous voice, he did all of those promos for us. And all it said was, if anyone at any time in any way asks you what radio station you listen to, tell them WTMA. And we started it way before the Arbitron, and we ran it through the Arbitron rating. And, of course, all the other stations reported us to Arbitron for unfair programming and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And all we had to do was go back to Arbitron and say, no, that's not true. This is part of our normal programming. That we've been doing this for the last 6 months. You know, that was something we were taking a chance with because we didn't really know what Arbitron was going to decide, but they accepted that explanation. And John was pretty sly. He had a few tricks up his sleeve, and I don't want to give away any programming things here, but it was a nice station to work for. I mean, everything came together at the right time, at the right place, and it was just a wonderful experience.
What are you proudest of during your time at WTMA?
I think the programming, learning the system of how the music was rotated, and specifically what records to play and not to play. I think that was the defining moment for me, and the one that really, that one rating, everything, like I said, just kind of came together. It was not so much the records that you play, it's how you play them. You have to know when to get on them and when to get off of them and how heavy to rotate them and when to back off from that. And that, to me, was the defining moment, was being able to learn that system and then implement it and sit back and watch it work, you know, week after week after week.
Do you remember any songs in particular that WTMA went out on a limb for that later became big hits? Something that WTMA might have started, you know, weeks or months before anybody else in the country?
You know, I don't, because we didn't do that. New records, new music, it's an unknown in a lot of cases. And the philosophy was, let the other radio stations take the risks and make the hits, and then we'll play them. So we very seldom went out on the limb and added anything early. For most of the time, we were probably the last station to add a record on its playlist. But that was the philosophy, so we didn't go out on new music like that. Now, of course, we had the tune sheet that we printed every week.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if I should admit this or not. There were things on the tune sheet that never got near being played on the air at the radio station.
I think the statute of limitations has run out on that.
Yeah, I would sometimes add records in there as hit bounds and stuff to kind of get in the good graces of the record promotion people. Of course, the ratings kept us there to begin with, but yeah, every once in a while when they'd need a favor, we'd put a song in there as hit bound, and they could go to other stations and say, well, look, TMA is playing it, and we reaped a lot of favors as a result of that.
Now, I understand WTMA was looked at by the record industry and other radio people as being one of the premier radio stations in the South when it came to Top 40. Did you get any of that when you were there?
Oh, yeah, constantly, all the time. If WTMA would add a record, these record companies could pretty much use that to get a lot of stations in the South and other parts of the country, too, really, to add that record and start playing it on their air. So, yeah, there was a lot of pressure there from these record guys. And, you know, once they understood the system and how it worked, how we played records in Charleston, then they'd back off a little bit. But every once in a while it would be, hey, you know, I could really use a favor on this. Or, you know, if you can do this for me, I'll do this for the station. And so, you know, every once in a while we did put something in there and add it. But, yeah, there was a lot of status with TMA. And a lot of people in the industry around the South looked to TMA as kind of the guiding light as to what records to play and not to play.
You mentioned before the research you did, checking in with local record stores and stuff to see what WTMA should play. Once you started doing that and got the chance to actually play the music that was being researched well in Charleston, how do you think the WTMA on-air playlist, the songs that was actually played, compared to that of other top 40 radio stations in the country? And I'm asking that because today it seems like if it's, you know, number one in New York, it's also number one in Charleston and number one in Indianapolis. You know, people go by a more of a national status. But back in the 70s, I understand that a lot of radio stations, you would have songs that would be hits in Charleston that nobody would ever hear of in Memphis, and vice versa. Was that the case when you were there?
That was definitely the case when I was there. The whole music industry is totally different today than it was back then. You had to play what your market dictated that you play. And yeah, there were records that were hits, and regional records, songs in Charleston that I'd never heard of before that we had to keep in our oldies recurrence and play, and songs we'd add in the summer that I'd never heard of before, but they were Charleston hits. We had to play them.
Especially beach music. Probably not too much beach music there in Salt Lake City where you're from.
Absolutely none. They didn't know what it was. But yeah, there were songs that, oh, Willie T and The Showman, I still remember them. That's crazy. But yeah, we'd add those songs every summer to the playlist, and Motown was big on beach music, too.
All right, when you were there, was WTMA still simulcasting on their FM frequency, 95.1, or had they switched to something else?
No, they'd already switched when I got there. They were doing beautiful music, WPXI.
Uh-huh, and did they later switch to an urban format, an African-American format?
They did, and oddly enough, this was right after we had that book with the big numbers on TMA.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided they were going to switch Pixie, as we called it, to to an R&B format.
Or Super Soul 95, right?
Yeah, Urban Today, I guess, is the term for it. And it took a while. We had a couple of good books at TMA, and then we made the switch, and we shot ourselves in the foot. The first book out, Pixie, with that new format, was number one.
Wow.
In fact, they were number one in Quarter Hours and number two in Cumes, and TMA was just the opposite, number one in Cumes and number two in Quarter Hours. But what none of us realized was that really the music of Charleston is that R&B music. And I don't call TMA a top 40. I really look at it as a mass appeal radio station because, I mean, if it was a black record or a country record, if it was selling good, we'd play it. It didn't matter. But, yeah, Pixie came along and just ate our dust.
Was there any thought or talk at the time about putting WTMA as it was on the FM frequency?
Not at all.
I think years later they talked about it, but they eventually decided to keep WTMA on AM and make 95.1 95SX.
Yeah.
That's around 1980.
That would have been cool if they'd have put TMA on it.
Yeah, it would have been. TMA would still be here today, probably playing music. But, yeah, the station is doing well as a news talk station.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, but Pixie, nobody could believe that when it happened. It was like, oh, wow. You know, what have we done?
Anything that you look back at your time at TMA as being, well, you know, I did all these great things, but I really wish that this could have happened. I wish that I could have put more effort into this, or I wish the situation had become different.
The only regret I have is leaving. It was a great experience. Every minute of every day I was there. But I could have stuck around a little bit longer, I guess.
So why'd you leave?
I don't know. I was just kind of getting restless, I guess. I looked at my situation there. It was a great situation, but there really wasn't anywhere else in the organization that, you know, you could go to. John wasn't going to go anywhere, and, you know, there was no place else to go. And I ran across this great job, and Burwell says, oh, he was selling pots and pans. Yeah, it was, but the way it was marketed and stuff was ingenious. So I left chasing the almighty dollar and had a lot of fun doing that for a while. But
this was for a non-radio job, right?
Not a radio job.
Yeah.
When I left, I got some incredible offers. Kent Burkhart called and offered me a gig, and Capitol Records called and wanted me to be the promotion man working out of Atlanta. And I turned both of those down and put my nose to the ground and went for this other thing full force, and it worked for a while, and when that stopped working, I got back into radio again.
All right, where did you work in radio after you left TMA, after this other thing petered out?
Well, by the time that fell through, I was back in Salt Lake City, so I started back there. Started working at a small little station out in the suburbs that never had a rating it could call its own, and I took the system for TMA and plugged it in, but the market was changing then, and this was an adult contemporary station. So I didn't do the market research like I should have. I used Bill Gavin's chart every week that came out in his little magazine and rotated the records from that. And I was there for a couple of years, and they were starting to come up and get numbers and ratings and stuff. But part of my gig in the morning drive there was to rip and read five-minute newscast. And the news director of the News Talk radio station in Salt Lake heard me one morning and called me and asked me if I'd come over and read the news for him. So I left music and got into news radio and worked in Salt Lake on that for a while, and then came here to San Antonio, Texas, and worked in that another 15 years.
Wow.
Back in the early 90s, along with radio, my wife and I started a photography studio doing wedding photography.
So I guess you eventually got out of radio and got into something else, huh?
Well, I got out of the radio and we did the photography for a while. We just closed that down here a couple of years ago. So I'm basically retired now and hanging out, having a good time.
So what made WTMA the success that it was? Why was it a great radio station to work for, and why was it a good radio station for Charleston at that time?
Well, it was great to work for because of the people who were there and the talents that they had, and the people running the radio station knew what to do and how to run it to be successful, and they did not compromise those standards. As far as people of Charleston, they got to hear a great radio station, and the kids grew up listening to that. It was like a major market station in Charleston, and the entertainment that they had and the fun and the excitement. We always had a contest or a promotion going constantly, all the time. We'd beef them up for the ratings, but we kept them going all the time. So, again, we couldn't be accused of trying to manipulate the ratings, but the entertainment value of it, I think, gave Charleston a lot.